This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. John Oliver's satirical new show Last Week Tonight is back with new episodes Sunday nights on HBO. And Oliver is back for a return visit to Fresh Air. He moved to the U.S. from England in 2006 to become a correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Oliver started his HBO show in 2014. He often starts the show with a comic, trenchant review of the week's news, and then he takes a deep dive into one news story, a story that you may not have been following, a story you may not have thought was even interesting, but through a combination of comedy and journalism, he makes it very funny and very informative, and you realize how important that story is. Last week, he did a story on the Italian parliamentary elections and the traction the far right has been getting. Last Sunday, in the wake of the Parkland school shooting and calls to boycott the NRA and NRA TV, which is streamed by several big tech companies, Oliver thought it was worth asking exactly what is NRA TV. In describing it, he showed clips of NRA TV shows devoted to buying guns and using guns. In this excerpt, Oliver talks about how NRA TV even has a women's channel.
Now, one of the NRA's female-focused programs, Love at First Shot, is explicitly about getting women more comfortable with the idea of owning or firing guns. And in one episode, they took a woman who was nervous about firearms and really threw her in at the deep end.
Okay, we're going to go straight into rifles. And we're going to do it with an AR-15.
Okay.
I know you probably heard about them on the news and everything else.
I hit the target.
You did? How did it feel?
Not as scary as I think I was anticipating.
Exactly. It's just this nice, light poof of happiness.
Yeah.
A light poof of happiness. It's a little weird to describe a semi-automatic rifle the way Bob Ross describes a f***ing cloud. But once Love at First Shot has women hooked, the upselling begins, which does actually make sense. Industry research has shown that women will spend hundreds of dollars on accessories in addition to their guns. So you can kind of understand why Love at First Shot functions as a kind of QVC for firearms, showcasing products like mag loaders, targets, gun cases, and handbags.
Okay, so as you see here, I've got a couple of different style options for you. There are a lot of different varieties of exteriors, but a lot of them really have the same structure in terms of concealed carry.
I never would have imagined these little neat pockets and hidden closures. Knowing that you can close it, it does put my mind at ease with it, so it's pretty cool.
Girl, you don't even need a gun because people are going to die when they see that bag.
John Oliver, welcome to Fresh Air, and glad your show is back on HBO.
Thank you.
So I know you do stories on the show that often take like weeks to research, but was this show about NRA TV done in response to Parkland?
No, actually. We started watching NRA TV back in December, so we've watched almost all of it, and we were thinking this might be just an interesting bunch of material to show people, showing them something they hadn't seen before. And then when Parkland happened, it slightly recontextualized the piece from kind of, here's something that you would never think of watching, to here is something you may have heard about because of boycotts, and yet when people have called for boycotts, they're not necessarily entirely sure exactly what they are calling to have boycotted. It made it more relevant than we actually intended it to be.
What was it like for you to watch all of the NRA TV?
Well, when you watch all of it, it kind of has a pretty profound effect on you because what we're trying to show you is little pieces, but when you watch the whole thing, it does give you pause. It kind of makes you panic because it's just wave after wave of fear-mongering, and it can make you think, oh, maybe I need to have a gun, which is entirely the point. I guess that's what was interesting. The distance that we found interesting was, you know, the NRA portrays itself as its MO being, fiercely, dogmatically defending the Second Amendment, and yet NRA TV really is just, to an extent, shilling for gun companies.
And selling a lot of products.
Yeah, it's about saying that you need a gun so that you will buy a gun. It's infomercial.
So I always imagine your staff being a combination of journalists and comics. And the way it happens in my head,
yeah,
because I'm not there and I don't know anything about what's really going on. But the way it happens in my head is that you have a group of journalists who do this deep dive into a story, and then a group of comedy writers who turn that story into a comedic take on, you know, using all the investigative stuff that the journalists have come up with, that then the comics would, you know, transform that into a comic take on this really important story.
So yeah, that's a pretty good guess.
Oh, okay.
That's a pretty good guess, Terry. You've just revealed our secret sauce live on air.
Tell me how it really works.
You've just Colonel Sanders'd our process. That's basically it. You know, we have researchers, we have footage producers, and they go away to look at a story and to check that it's been reported accurately, or whether the story has shifted in any way, meaning that lots of the data that we'd be using would be out of date, and whether there is footage through which we can tell the story. Then once we feel like the basic foundations are solid, then we can kind of bring comedic writing to that process and work out how we'll tell the story, what elements of it we want to use, what kind of story arc we want to employ, and then we write jokes. So jokes come late.
Sometimes your segments, your long takeout segments, end with like a call to action. One of my favorites was about how easy it is to call yourself a church and get tax-exempt status.
Right.
And then with the tax-exempt status and various other loopholes, collect money from your followers, exploiting their problems and making promises you can't keep, and then pocketing the money. So you became a mega reverend and started a church called Our Lady of Perpetual Exemption.
Exemption, that's yes. Correct. Praise be.
So with your wife, Wanda Jo Oliver, played by Rachel Dratch, you did a little TV show at the end of your segment on televangelists, and did something on your church, Our Lady of Perpetual Exemption. And I want to play that clip.
Praise be to all of you watching us tonight or joining us online at www.ourladyofperpetualexemption.com.
But most of all, praise be to the IRS, most permissive of government agencies.
Wanda Jo, I have heard the word of prophecy.
Hallelujah! What did it say, my John?
I'll tell you, my Wanda. It says the viewers at home must plant a seed.
A seed! An almighty seed!
Yes.
Preferably in the form of cash, although we do take checks.
It can be $5, it can be $10, it can be $77. We need you to sow your biggest seed.
That's money. Don't send us seed.
That's right, Wanda. Please do not send us actual seeds.
Because we ain't interested in your seed.
We ain't interested. Please send us your actual money to this address at the bottom of your screen. If you do this, and this is real, great things will happen to you, and that's apparently something I'm allowed to say.
Praise! Praise legal! Praise our tax attorney! Praise loopholes in all their blessed loopiness!
Let me talk to the brothers and sisters at home. Do you have debt?
Debt be gone!
Do you have lupus?
A demon plague!
Touch your hand to the screen right now, and we shall cure it. Touch your hand to the screen right now.
Curse you, demon lupus. Bedevil us no more.
Curse you, lupus. You probably didn't even know that you had lupus, but you did, but you don't anymore. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. It's a miracle tonight.
It's a miracle.
Miracle. Do not delay. Call this actual number right now, 1-800-THIS-IS-LEGAL. Because amazingly, all of this is. This is all legal. Call this toll-free number and plant your seed.
That's really hilarious. John
Rachel
Oliver,
Dratch is so funny.
It's John Oliver and Rachel Dratch on an episode from last season of Last Week Tonight on HBO. So, as you said, it's legal to say great things will come to you if you do this, if you pay the money and everything. So how did you find out what you could say?
I guess the fascinating thing for us there was to try and show, not just tell people that this was possible, because it feels, if you know, it's theoretically alarming to have someone say, and it's completely legal to do this. It's kind of viscerally affecting when you have someone say, give me your money, I will cure your lupus. Give me your money, if you do, you will get more money in return. Seriously, give me your money. And people sent it in. No tax obligations. It was kind of showing that you could hack into this system and everything was allowed. So, yeah, people sent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to us.
Why did they do that? Why did they? It's obviously,
well,
it's obviously a comedy sketch.
Because it's fun. Okay, you know, we sent them back things. However, once they sent money, we sent them letters back, the kind of letters that we'd been receiving from the pastor that we'd been in contact with over the previous 6 months. He had, you know, an outline of his hand, and you could put your hand on his hand and pray with him that way. So we had an outline, I believe, of my rear end so that you could sit where I sat and we could pray together. So we kind of got into a correspondence with people. Then we eventually had to shut it down because it would have become our entire job. But yeah, the point of it was to show that the barrier of entry to this is too low. And when it's this low, you can have bad actors enter.
So what did you have to do to become a church?
We had to just register as a church. I believe we did it in Texas, I believe.
So what did you do with the money you collected?
We gave it to Doctors Without Borders.
And did people know you were going to do that?
No. We could have kept it. That's the thing. We just didn't want it. So we gave it to, to them. Because they could do more with it than we could.
I remember when I was growing up and Oral Roberts was on TV and he'd have like a tent revival meeting and do all this healing, like put your hands on the screen. And he'd put his hands toward the camera. So it would be as if you could put your hand on his hand and you do something similar like that in the bit that we just heard. Mm-hmm. And so like he's doing a tent revival and I'm like a Jewish kid growing up in an apartment building in Brooklyn and the whole thing just looks like so different to me.
Yeah.
So unlike anything in my neighborhood.
Sure. It was, watching it, getting glimpses of it in England, it was kind of this curiosity of, wow, look at this. Honestly, it was just look at this level of enthusiasm. You know, I don't come from a country that has a great deal of like visible demonstration of feeling. So watching someone really commit. Like the Anglican Church in England is a very dour, monotone, like you mumble your prayers and then you return to the holes that you came out of. And whereas the quintessentially American enthusiasm of faith was already fascinating. But again, like the point wasn't so much that, the point was more the toxicity of seed faith because it preys upon people who cannot afford it. Like the idea that you want to just make a gamble, like send money to a pastor, maybe my lupus will go away, that doesn't feel benign to me, but it is certainly less insidious in my mind than when they're directly targeting their message at people that do not have money. So they're saying, are you drowning in bills? Best thing to do, ignore those bills, send me money. Money will come back to you. So at that point, you are targeting the weakest, most vulnerable people with escalating medical bills, and that feels profoundly wrong to me. And so that outrage was what we were building our stupidity on top of.
Were you threatened or harassed by anyone within any of those churches or any of the leaders of those churches?
I mean, I think the big threat really is afterlife related, right? It's kind of, I think it's going to be, have fun now. You'll be dancing in the flickering flames of hell.
So I want to give another example of you doing something related to the story that you're following, but doing it in the real world, not just in the confines of the studio. And this is really hilarious. I mean, you've been trying to slip information into Trump's mind, knowing that he watches Fox TV and that he often like tweets things that he's just heard on Fox.
Yeah.
So you actually bought ads on Fox TV, parroting an ad that often runs on Fox. And so to set this up, I just want to play the real Catheter Cowboy ad. Or at least one of the real Catheter Cowboy ads that's run on Fox. And then we'll play the way that you parodied it, and then we'll talk about how you've done it. So here's a real ad that's run on Fox TV.
Attention, catheter patients on Medicare. I'm a professional cowboy, and I use catheters. Been cowboying for 25 years. I've broken 14 bones, had 2 concussions, and a punctured lung. I know pain, and I don't want any more of it, especially when I cath.
Okay, so that's an excerpt of a real ad.
Yeah. And real ad. Very real. Painfully, painfully real.
And here's the John Oliver Last Week Tonight ad, or at least one in a series of ads. And this one is about healthcare policy. And again, it's kind of geared to an audience of one. It's geared to President Trump to slip real information into his mind as he watches Fox News.
Attention catheter patients.
Hi, me again. I'm a professional cowboy and I use catheters. Been cowboying for 25 years and there's two things I know. I don't like pain when I cath. And healthcare is a complicated business. Everybody knows that. Literally, everybody. Also, if my premiums go up and subsidies go down, I'm going to wind up paying more. That's basic math there, fella. That's like replacing my catheter with a garden hose. I don't want that. I do not like pain when I cath. The point is, if that happens, millions of folks like me might get real angry, which is worth thinking about if you're the sort of person who really likes being popular. You get that, right? Right? You get that. Right?
Okay, so that's the parody ad from Last Week Tonight. So tell us the backstory to that.
Well, it was, I think it was our first story of last year, of last season, when we felt like we had to talk about Trump's relationship with the truth before we talked about anything else that year, because it felt like there'd been a seismic shift in the way that we were going to collectively live our lives in America. Yeah, the end of that was realizing that he was receiving a huge amount of information from early morning Fox News programming, which is not the kind of place you ideally want someone getting information that they will then act on. So this is a guy who has access to the best information available, and he's choosing to get it from these three circus clowns on a couch. So then we found a clip of him on Air Force One with the commercials from Fox News blaring loudly in the background. And we realized, oh, he watches the commercials too. So at that point, we felt this is the best way to try and get to him, is that you can become part of his morning briefing now. That's what's so egregious. Fox and Friends has always been a ludicrous program, but they have a huge responsibility now because they have the president's ear. So when they pass on misleading information or poorly framed data, it's going to have a real world impact. So what we wanted to do was try and slip information into him when he's at his happiest and most relaxed, which is when he's zoning out to Fox and Friends.
So was Fox willing to run these ads?
Yeah, they ran them.
So do you have any indication of whether the president actually saw your catheter cowboy ads?
I don't.
Wouldn't you like to know?
I would love to know. I will say that his actions would indicate that he didn't see them.
Okay. So we haven't spoken since Donald Trump was elected president. Were you surprised by the outcome?
I was a little less surprised than perhaps I thought I would be. I mean, I'd watched the Brexit vote earlier in the year, which had been kind of turbocharged by some of the same, social issue baiting and misinformation being spread. And so I was kind of so profoundly disappointed by that decision that as the election night results came in America, my muscle memory was kicking in of, I think I know how this story plays out. So, yeah, I was less surprised than maybe I thought I'd be.
As an immigrant, how is the anti-immigrant rhetoric affecting you? And I don't, Americans love Brits. So yeah. It's not like you're being demonized by Donald Trump.
Not as much as the president loves
British.
Norwegians. Norwegians are the gold standard.
I know.
For completely benign reasons, I'm sure. I can't think what it is about a Norwegian which is particularly attractive.
But I wonder how being an immigrant is affecting how you're hearing the anti-immigration rhetoric.
Well, I mean, I guess I guess the really honest answer to that is it probably hurts more because I've been through the immigration system, so I have a slightly more detailed understanding of some of its flaws than the average American naturally would have, because there's no need to go through it. Also, you know, I have this kind of newfound love of America because I've been here 11 years. It's my home. I have an American wife. I have an American son. The sense of whether or not you belong here, I feel like this is my home, right? So when people say, even to me, go back to where you came from, or, you know, what gives you the right to talk about America, despite the fact it's my home? It taps into like feelings that are pretty raw for me. So the way that immigrants have been treated is, I guess what I would say is, I clearly have the nicest possible version of the toxicity of feelings about immigrants, in that, like you say, I'm British. You know, there is a fundamental affection, to an extent, for British people, Piers Morgan aside. So I don't have anything like the problems that people that don't look or sound like me have. But the kind of deep injustice of how they're treated, I can't say it doesn't like personally affect me or offend me. I kind of feel it personally because I want to be here. I really love it here. I chose to be here, and I love it here now. You know, I love it here, even though the country is kind of at its worst in recent years in terms of its attitude towards immigrants. And I would still make a case for people coming here. That's the crazy thing. I guess I still, even though I'm not a very optimistic person, I still have a fundamental faith that America will correct this path.
Well, it's so great to talk with you again. Thank you so much for coming back to our show.
Oh, you're welcome, Terry. It's always fun to talk to you.
John Oliver hosts the HBO series Last Week Tonight, which is shown Sunday nights. With her new film, A Wrinkle in Time, Ava DuVernay has become the first woman of color to direct a motion picture with a budget over $100 million. She began her career making low-budget indies, including Middle of Nowhere, and has since become known for her films Selma, about a chapter of the civil rights movement, and 13th, a documentary about mass incarceration. Film critic Justin Chang has this review of A Wrinkle in Time.
Before it became a beloved touchstone of children's literature, Madeleine L'Engle's 1962 novel, A Wrinkle in Time, was rejected by no fewer than 26 publishers. What young reader, the conventional thinking went, could possibly warm to this complex, cerebral story, with its mix of fantasy and science fiction, interplanetary travel and quantum physics, secular philosophy and Christian parable? There was also the fear that readers wouldn't warm to a science fiction story with a female protagonist, in this case, Meg Murray, a bookish 14-year-old girl with a weakness for self-doubt and an aptitude for advanced mathematics. Time itself has long since proven the skeptics wrong. A Wrinkle in Time has now inspired a much-anticipated Disney event movie from the director Ava DuVernay, turning her attention from independent productions like Middle of Nowhere, Selma, and 13th to a splashier, more family-friendly canvas. She's made a big, bright, unwieldy movie full of trippy colors, kaleidoscopic visuals, and eager empowerment platitudes. A movie that wears its heart on its tie-dyed sleeve. She has also reimagined Meg as a young girl of color, played by the gifted Storm Reid, and surrounded her with a multi-ethnic ensemble. It's a choice entirely consistent with DuVernay's longtime advocacy for greater inclusiveness in the movie industry, and it dovetails intuitively with the rejection of conformity that lies at the heart of Langle's story. That story is much the same as it was in the book. Meg and her intellectually gifted younger brother, Charles Wallace, played by Derek McCabe, are both misfits at school, where everyone gossips about their scientist father, played by Chris Pine, who vanished on a mission years ago, leaving them alone with their mother, also a scientist, played by Gugu Mbatha-Raw. But one dark and stormy night, the Murrays are visited by an eccentric celestial guardian named Mrs. What's-It, played by a spirited Reese Witherspoon.
Call me Mrs. What's-It.
Mrs. Who?
No, Mrs. What's-It. Mrs. Who is, she's like a billion years older and way more knowledgeable.
What can I do for you, Mrs. What's-It?
I caught her stealing sheets. Guys, she's harmless.
You're six. Come on. What do you know about harmless?
Have I ever been wrong?
Well, one of these days you might be Charles Wallace.
Oh, I highly doubt that. He's one of the greatest minds in recent history. He's prodigious. But of course, we can't take any credit for our talents. It's how we use them that counts.
Mrs. What's-It is soon joined by Mrs. Who, played by Mindy Kaling, whose every line of dialogue draws on famous quotations from writers including Shakespeare, Khalil Gibran, and the hip-hop duo Outkast. And then there is Mrs. Witch, the oldest, wisest, and most physically imposing of the three guardians, played with a deific glow by Oprah Winfrey. This benevolent trinity sends Meg and Charles Wallace on a planet-hopping adventure to rescue their father. They do this by harnessing the power of the Tesseract, a mysterious force that can transport someone swiftly from one end of the galaxy to another. As the characters plunge through a series of space-time wormholes, we share in their sense of disorientation, sometimes pleasurably, sometimes frustratingly. The worlds they visit are certainly eye-popping, from a lush green landscape that brings Avatar's Pandora to mind, to a mountainside cavern where an oracle, played by Zach Galifianakis, has some crucial counsel to impart. The big good versus evil showdown takes place on Kamazots, a chilling Orwellian planet whose inhabitants' every thought is controlled by a computer-like brain called It. But where Langle effortlessly got inside her characters' heads, DuVernay's approach remains a resolutely exterior one. Visually, the movie keeps throwing stuff at us, mind-bending effects and lightning-quick shifts in scenery, not to mention multiple costume changes for Witherspoon, Kaling, and Winfrey. But you can understand why Langle's increasingly abstract story has so often been described as unfilmable. I'm glad DuVernay and her screenwriters, Jennifer Lee and Jeff Stockwell, didn't back down from that challenge. But I wish A Wrinkle in Time were more focused, more rigorous, that its flow of fantastical imagery cohered into a revelatory new understanding of Langle's themes and insights, rather than an earnest, clunky reiteration of them. But the sheer go-for-broke exuberance of DuVernay's approach works its own kind of magic. For all its gaudiness, the movie is worlds away from a cynical Disney live-action adaptation like Alice in Wonderland. A Wrinkle in Time is a nakedly emotional film that builds to a climactic celebration of the power of love. And it's here that DuVernay at last claws her way onto Langle's wavelength. Her movie believes fervently that a young girl's imagination can change and even save the world. I walked in believing as much myself, but walking out, I believed it a little bit more.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. This is Fresh Air Weekend. My guest, Sarah McBride, was the first transgender person to speak at a national political convention of a major party. It was the night Hillary Clinton accepted the Democratic Party's nomination for president. Sarah was 25 years old. She had already made history during the Obama presidency as the first transgender woman White House intern. Through her work advocating for LGBTQ rights, she met the transgender man who became her husband. But he died of cancer, leaving Sarah a widow at the age of 24. So you can see why, although she's only 27, she has a lot to write about in her new memoir, Tomorrow Will Be Different: Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. Ever since she was a child, Sarah felt that politics was her calling. It was on her last day serving as student body president at American University that she came out as trans. She's now the national press secretary for the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest LGBTQ civil rights organization. Sarah McBride, welcome to Fresh Air. So you came out as trans while you were still a student at American University. This was on the last day of your tenure as student president. Your coming out story with your fellow students is not a story of getting rejected. It's a story of getting supported. Your fraternity brothers, because you'd been in a fraternity when you were still identifying as male, your fraternity brothers came to your room to offer their support. Describe that scene to us.
A year before, I had joined a fraternity in sort of one last-ditch effort to prove to myself and to other people that I was someone I knew I wasn't. And so when I came out, I knew I would be disaffiliating from that fraternity. I knew that my relationships with those brothers might be a little bit different. But when I came out, I heard from so many fraternity brothers, and then eventually I opened the door to my student government office at American University and found about 10 fraternity brothers standing in a line with their Greek letters on, with their arms outstretched to give me a hug. And I think it was such a clear statement from them that while I may not be their fraternity brother anymore, I'd always be their sister. And that experience was empowering for me, and it demonstrated that with stories and with education, most people will respond in the right way when a loved one or a friend or a neighbor comes out as trans. But it also highlighted my own privilege. Coming out up until that point had been the hardest thing that I had ever done, but it was still relatively easy compared to the experiences of so many transgender people across the country and around the world when they come out.
So when you were a member of the fraternity, did you have to do a lot of bro things?
Fortunately, the fraternity that I joined was one that was a little less filled with as much masculinity as sort of your stereotypical fraternity. But I did participate, I think, throughout my life in an identity that I knew wasn't my own, that felt like a costume. You know, I talk about in the book how Halloween was one of the few days that I could come out and be myself with a little less sort of social stigma. And every other day for me was like Halloween. Every other day was like dressing up in a costume, performing an act that I certainly wasn't prepared for and frankly caused me a lot of pain. And that existed in some of the interactions with the fraternity. It existed in so many other aspects of life because I think people don't fully realize just how often we are interacting with our gender on a day-to-day basis.
Your mother, when you came out to her, said initially, "I can't handle this. I feel like you're dying." How did you respond to that?
Well, I told my mother that she was keeping her child and gaining a daughter, that I would still be the same person with the same interests and passions and sense of humor, most of all the same smile, which I had sort of been known for since I was a baby. And so over time, she realized that while the packaging may look a little bit different, that the gift wrapping may look a little bit different, that I'm still the same person that she's always loved. And frankly, we're even closer and stronger for it. It also was a reaction that I anticipated. I had read before coming out about the different ways family members respond. And I knew that that was a likely response, particularly since they would be supportive. I knew that at the same time, they'd still mourn what felt like my passing. And it took my brother, who's a radiation oncologist, telling my mom, "I deal with young kids who have terminal cancer. And I see every day their families mourn those losses. You're not losing your child. Your child is not dying. They aren't going anywhere." And I think it took my brother sort of putting things into perspective a little bit more for her to sort of get out of that fog and begin to move forward.
So when you did come out as trans, what did you want your image to be as a woman? Once you were free to wear whatever you wanted and wear makeup if you choose to, and, you know, just present yourself in any way you please.
Well, I think like most women, I didn't really know at the exact start exactly who I was and what my expression would be and sort of what I wanted to be as a woman in that sense. I think there was this burst of femininity in many ways, of pent-up femininity that I kept inside for so long. I think most women who are sort of exploring their gender expression go through that in middle school or high school, but I went through that in college and right after. But I think I sort of eventually landed in this place of what I call sort of casual femininity, of being able to express myself as I authentically feel, be able to sort of have the freedom. But I think as a trans person, I'm caught in between this rock and a hard place. I think many trans people are, in that if we aren't feminine enough as trans women, we're told that we aren't real women. But if we're too feminine, we're told that we're caricatures, as if masculinity is some sort of natural state of being or a default. And I think it's emblematic of this larger policing of gender that all women face, and the navigation that we all have to go through in finding ourselves.
Through your work as an activist, you met Andy, a transgender man who also worked on LGBTQ issues. He worked at the Center for American Progress. You eventually married. You write that it was hard for you to start dating once you came out as trans. Were you insecure about having an intimate relationship as a woman, as a trans woman? Worried that a man might not understand?
I was very hesitant. I mean, I'm 27. I've been out for 6 years, and I think that insecurity continues to exist just generally. Even with a transgender man, Andy, who I began dating 3 months after I came out publicly, there was this fear that he would eventually find out that I'm not the person that he hoped I was or the woman that I knew I was. That there was this degree of insecurity, of sort of worrying that the entire world was seeing me just as this newly out transgender person and not in my whole humanity. And even dating a transgender man, I was incredibly insecure about that and incredibly worried that I wouldn't be able to find love, that no one would be able to love me as me. Because growing up, the only examples I had for transgender people really in pop culture were dead bodies in a drama or punchlines in a comedy.
So I had asked you when you were in college and you were dating a woman before you were publicly identifying as a transgender woman, I asked you if there are gender roles within the relationship. So I'm going to ask you that about your relationship with Andy. Were there gender roles?
You know, I think
because it's such an interesting, yeah. Like, since you're a trans woman and he was a trans man, you just like the possibilities there for gender nonconformity and
right.
For confusing gender roles is so interesting. So I'd love to hear about your experience with that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that in our relationship, there was a blurring of gender lines, right? There was a lack of gender conformity in the way we presented. And you know, both of us being trans, you know, I think people might have preconceived notions of how we'll act one way or the other. But I will say at the same time, it's difficult to sort of talk about our gender relationships because so much of our relationship ended up being consumed by his disease and the fact that he was diagnosed with cancer. And so much of the relationship and the roles we had were based on this sort of patient caregiver relationship. But, you know, I think for us, our relationship was, what was great about it was there was no expectations when it came to gender, that we sort of let each other just be.
So you mentioned Andy's sickness. He got a sore on his tongue that wouldn't heal. It turned out to be a malignant tumor. The cancer had spread to the other side of his tongue as well. He needed surgery to remove a major part of his tongue. He worried that he wouldn't be able to speak. After surgery, he needed a tracheotomy, and then he was sent home, and you had to clean his tracheostomy tube. This drives me crazy. I mean, anybody who's had to be a home health caregiver to a loved one after a hospitalization, there are things that you have to do nowadays at home that yourself that in the past, like a skilled nurse with a lot of training would be doing. And it's terrifying.
It is. It is. It is. It is horrifying. And, you know, we had exceptional care in every hospital and every with pretty much every doctor we had, although, of course, there are always a few exceptions. But when Andy was discharged after a 7-day stay at the hospital after major surgery, he came home, as you mentioned, with a tracheostomy tube, a feeding tube through his nose, and several bags collecting blood. I mean, it was a startling sight to see him when he was being discharged. And we were left with very little help. And for someone who at the time was 22 or 23, just out of college, I didn't quite know what I was doing. I didn't really know what I was stepping into. And my sort of fear of what if Andy dies on me right here and now was heightened because I really didn't even have that many life experiences that prepared me for those moments.
After his treatments, he was told he was cancer-free, but not long after that, tumors were found in his lungs, and he was coughing a lot. And he asked you, if it turns out that this is terminal, would you marry me? And you did marry. In fact, you moved it up to a sooner date when things weren't looking good for Andy. You asked Bishop Eugene Robinson to preside over the ceremony. He had been the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church. What was your ceremony like?
Well, when Andy found out that his cancer was back, he asked me, as you said, if it turns out to be terminal, would you marry me? And at first, I didn't want to give him an answer because I didn't want him to think that if I said yes immediately that I was giving up. And so I said, well, let's hold off. Let's see what the doctors say. And then we can have that conversation. And then when we got the news that it was terminal, I told him that I wasn't going anywhere, that I'd be right by his side, and that, of course, the answer was yes to his question. Initially, we thought he had about a year left to live, and we planned to have a wedding in the fall. When he got the re-diagnosis, it was late July. But then as his health began to deteriorate more rapidly than we anticipated and the doctors anticipated, his mother and I talked and decided that it would be best to talk to Andy about moving up the wedding. And so we did, and of course it was met with Andy wondering whether I was giving up. I told him, we're just talking about moving it up so that you can be ready for your chemo and your radiation, and it's clearly going to take more out of you than we anticipate, so why don't we just do it while you're as strong as possible. We didn't anticipate that we were really going to have any kind of ceremony to speak of. We brought in Bishop Gene about a week later, and we said to him that we were planning on marrying, and we asked him to preside. He had worked with us. He was a close friend of ours, and of course, as an out gay bishop, we knew that he would come to that wedding without any judgment to the love between two transgender people. And in 5 days, Bishop Gene and so many of our friends put together a beautiful wedding. Andy probably shouldn't have even made it to that wedding based on his health, but he rallied and he lasted just long enough to get married.
After Andy died, did the fact that you were married help you legally in doing things that you needed to do after he was gone?
Absolutely. The fact that Andy and I legally married without question made it easier in all of the different maze of forms and processes that one has to go through after someone passes. We wanted to make sure, I think, though, that wasn't really on our mind when we married. I think we were sort of so focused in the present. We were so clear-eyed about the moment we were in that it didn't really occur to us that being married would have an impact after he passed away when it came to things like forms and sort of estate planning and things like that. But it did help. I mean, it did make that process a little bit smoother. And throughout it, we were also cognizant of whether it was the funeral home that we were seeking out or any of the different clerks at banks or government offices that I was going to. you know, the potential for mistreatment or discrimination, even of Andy's body after he passed away, another indignity thrust upon transgender people even after they pass. But it definitely made it a smoother experience. It was still an incredibly challenging experience to go through and to navigate.
What were the issues? Were there issues that you had to face for the funeral, for dealing with Andy's body after he died because he was trans?
Too often when transgender people die, family members or funeral homes will end up dressing a body of a transgender person in the garments of the gender that they were assigned at birth instead of their gender identity. They're often deadnamed and misgendered.
Don't funeral homes usually ask you to bring clothes for your loved one?
So sometimes family members will bring clothes. So what I was going to say is we actually decided to have Andy cremated, but we wanted to make sure that it wasn't a funeral home that would misgender Andy, that even when we weren't there, that they would respect his gender identity and the words they used and the name they used. Sometimes transgender people, after they pass, their family members, if they aren't supportive, will ask the funeral home to dress them in clothes associated with their gender assigned at birth, as opposed to their gender identity. So there are a number of different ways in which transgender people, after they pass, can be disrespected. And fortunately, Bishop Jean went out and helped us find a funeral home that, even though Andy was being cremated, assured us that they would affirm his gender identity in everything they did.
So are you in a relationship now? Is it okay to ask you that?
It is okay to ask me that. I'm not in a relationship. You know, after a couple months after he passed, I did try a little bit, but there was so much love in that relationship that even several years later, I still feel like my cup runneth over with love. I still feel the love from that relationship, and I still feel it every day. And so I'm really not in a hurry. That's one thing I'm not in the hurry for. I'm in the hurry for change. I'm in the hurry for progress. But I'm not in the hurry to find a new relationship because I still feel that love.
Sarah McBride, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sarah McBride's new memoir is called Tomorrow Will Be Different: Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. This is Fresh Air Weekend.